all together now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. A major issue on all our minds is the economy. In a personal sense, we wonder, how will we pay our bills? Pay rent or make payments on a mortgage for our own home? Maybe start or expand a small business? In a broader sense, we keep hearing that cities, states, and even the federal government does not have enough money to pay its bills. What can we do to increase the ability of people to own their own homes, to start or expand our own business? What can we do to increase the ability of the government to pay its bills and continue to provide services for citizens? How can we have a more broad-based economic security? My guest today to talk with us about these and other issues is Mark Armstrong. Mark is the executive director of the Public Banking Institute, established to fund the new economy. The new economy includes co-ops, local small business, and renewable energy ventures. We need affordable credit generated from the deposits that our city and county and state governments currently put in Wall Street banks. Having worked for IBM Finance, Mark has had a career in designing banking applications and in developing technology partnerships, so he understands banking from the inside. Mark, welcome to All Together Now.
Hi, Eleanor. Good to be here.
Yeah, so happy you could join us. I'm so looking forward to interviewing you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to be interviewed.
Yeah. So listen, you know, this whole concept of public banking is really foreign to most people, and I myself had never really heard of it until I saw you speak at an event in Washington, D.C. just about a year ago as part of the Occupy Wall Street Education and Strategy sessions. So could you start by just talking about the idea of public banking and what problem it solves?
Sure. The idea of public banking is actually pretty straightforward, but keep in mind that it's only a means to an end. As Eleanor was mentioning, the whole purpose is to fund the new economy. It's to fund co-ops. It's to get money in the hands of people who need it so that they can build, you know, the solar panels or whatever is needed within the new economy, in particular to get off of fossil fuel, but in a larger sense, just to provide livelihoods for people, you know, to make gainful employment. And what banks do is make loans, and that's what a public bank would do. And what makes a public bank distinctive is that it is owned by the county or state government or large cities. And so, as a corporate entity that's owned by the government, it has a lot of latitude in terms of being able to make those loans and to direct money toward and get it to the hands of the people who need it. So the interesting aspect about a public bank is that it really is designed to serve the needs of the people as opposed to serve the needs of the shareholders, which is what we have right now in our society with Wall Street banks. So there are two main problems that a public bank solves, and one of them has to do with the existing system in place. Our state treasurers, our county treasurers, take all of our tax revenue and put that money into public banks. Into private banks. And
right.
So we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars. We're not talking about, you know, little small amounts. We're talking about huge amounts of money, which is being put into private banks. And you would think on the face of it, well, that's no problem. What they're doing is holding on to it and you know, releasing the funds to the city or the county or the state when they need it. But here's what happens is if there's for every $100 that's put on deposit into a private bank, there's another $100 of bank credit that can be created and used as an asset for that bank. Remember, a deposit to a bank is a liability. And because of double entry accounting, they have a license to create an equal value of assets on the other side. So what happens to those assets? For every $100 of public funds that are put into a private bank, that $100 of assets that are created, where does that go? And where that goes is it buys, the bank uses it to buy securities in Chinese manufacturers, or to buy Brazilian bonds, or to, in the case of B of A, to fund coal-fired plants in Chile. That $100 of credit is used really at cross purposes for the taxpayers who originally generated that $100 of deposits. And so the problem we're solving is that we're saying, look, let's take that billions and billions of dollars of public tax revenue, put it into public banks, and use the bank credit that's created, hundreds of billions of dollars worth, use that hundreds of billions of dollars of bank credit to serve the needs of the people. And it's really an easy value proposition, but that's the core idea behind public banking. And it's that problem that's being solved right now, which is, you know, our public monies are being used to further the private interest of large Wall Street banks. There's another problem. I'll get into that later, but that kind of gives you the idea.
Yeah, that's fabulous. So just to, you know, you want to repeat what I hear you saying here. Really, the way it works right now is we, the people, pay into, say, a city or state treasury when we pay our income tax or a sales tax. All that money goes into the state. And the state, when it receives those funds, right now, almost universally, puts that public money into a private bank. And then you know, use a bank just like we would use a bank, make deposits and then make withdrawals. But what you're saying is that what we could do is take that public money and put it into a publicly owned bank. And if we did that, then we could take that hundreds of billions of dollars you're talking about and redirect it in a way that actually meets the needs of the communities and the people. So
exactly.
You know, we're all concerned now, and we saw in 2008 the absolute recklessness of a lot of these Wall Street gargantuan financial institutions that were doing all kinds of funny deals with derivatives and credit default swaps and all kinds of high-risk so-called investments. It's really like high-stakes gambling, and they lost billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, and then we, the taxpayers, got stuck trying to bail them out so the whole economy wouldn't sink. But,
right.
You know, it's why should we, the taxpayer, let these people use our money that's being put into, you know, a city or a state treasury and let them, the Wall Street people, use it like a casino to take high-stakes bets that then they lose and then we again have to bail them out. Instead, we could put
right.
that money into a publicly owned bank, and then that money becomes available for people for real needs in the community, like if you want to buy a home and get a mortgage, if you want to start or expand a business, you could do that. If you want to build solar panels, you know, it would generate revenue that would then make it possible for more people to own homes and start and expand businesses. Is that the basic idea?
Yeah, that's the idea, and that's what they're doing in North Dakota. Fortunately, North Dakota, very much like any other country in this world except for England, Canada, and the United States, but North Dakota has a public bank, and they actually use it exactly as you're saying. They put the state treasurer puts the state tax revenues into their own bank, and they've been able to create upwards to $5 billion of credit, which is then lent out. And it's used to fund all sorts of businesses at rates as low as 1%. It's used to fund disaster recovery. You know, North Dakota has had its fair share of disasters, usually with flooding. But in 1997, there was a flood in Grand Forks as well as a fire downtown. And it was the largest, it was the most costliest disaster in terms of dollars that our country had experienced up till then. I think it was like $3 or $4 billion. Katrina was a whole other story afterwards, but But in 1997, the price tag was huge relative to what we'd experienced the 50 years prior to that. And what the Bank of North Dakota did was within a few weeks after the flood and the fire in Grand Forks, they had money in people's hands so that they could start rebuilding. And they were able to rebuild. And then over time, FEMA kicked in and was able to make grants and compensate people. And the loans were paid off from the bank. But the Bank of North Dakota stepped in and provided an incredibly valuable service to the people of that city in times of disaster. Now, contrast that with what happened in New Jersey and New York, where you had Hurricane Sandy, and many of the people there have complained about their being preyed upon by private banks. And there's not much of a safety net there. And yet in Grand Forks, North Dakota, the population survey was done in 2000, just 3 years after this flood. And Grand Forks, North Dakota, compared to East Grand Forks, which is in Minnesota, had only lost 3% of its population. East Grand Forks had lost 18% of its population. And so, you know, as disasters occur across our country, public banks can provide a very important service by getting hands in the getting money in the hands of people who need it, so mm-hmm. that they can rebuild and reestablish their livelihoods.
Yeah, so I think this whole model is fascinating and so promising. And the wonderful thing is, you know, my whole theme is build on what works. The wonderful thing is we actually have a model that works, that exists now, that the state of North Dakota has a publicly owned bank called the Bank of North Dakota, and it's been in existence for now over 92 years, serving the people of North Dakota. And I think it's the best kept secret in the whole economy in the United States, that this Bank of North Dakota, which is publicly owned, exists and has thrived for the past 92 years, almost a century, and yet really almost nobody knows about it. So since this is such a great model, let's take a closer look at that. And by the way, I think, you know, looking at it, that it is in part the fact that there is this publicly owned Bank of North Dakota that has helped the state of North Dakota be one of the most diversified, vibrant state economies in the whole of the United States. And I know some people will say, well, you know, they discovered oil in North Dakota, so, you know, it's the oil that makes the state economy so vibrant. And, you know, clearly oil brings money in. But there are other states that have oil that are not as diversified or healthy economies as North Dakota is. You know, you get Texas with kind of its boom and bust. And so the first question for you is, how significant do you think having this publicly owned Bank of North Dakota is in helping North Dakota have the most, one of the most diversified economies and the lowest unemployment rates in the country?
It's pretty significant. The North Dakota economy is about $40 billion a year. I think that was from 2011. And so their GDP is essentially $40 billion. Only a small fraction of that is oil and gas, which is growing. But one of the significant aspects of North Dakota is that it's not just an agricultural economy anymore. And part of the reason is because their bank has been funding different sectors of their economy and growing it. So, for instance, they give upwards to a few hundred thousand dollars in what's essentially seed funding for high-tech startups. They provide loans to light manufacturers as low as 1% per year for companies moving into particular regions, geographic areas of their state. They are very much focused on their unemployment rate, and for every $100,000 that's lent out, they actually require you to hire somebody. And so it's a jobs program as well as a bank loan in one package. And so they're very smart in terms of how they use their their bank credit to further the economic interests of the people in North Dakota. There's one more example I want to give, which has nothing to do with commercial lending. It has to do with infrastructure financing. And as we all know, infrastructure investment in this country has been lagging to the tune of, you know, a couple of trillion dollars in terms of what the need is. So what Bank of North Dakota does, there's no need to start a new infrastructure bank. Keep in mind, an infrastructure bank is a public entity that furthers the interests of very wealthy people because it takes their private money and uses it to invest in public projects. A public bank uses public money and public bank credit to further the interests of the people that the public bank represents. And so what North Dakota does is they actually, their largest loan last year was a $50 million loan to build a water pipeline in the western part of the state. And think about the financing behind something like that. So here you have what is bank credit from this public institution, which is used to fund this water pipeline. The people who are receiving the water pay for it, and they pay a small interest rate on the loan that was used to build that water pipeline. The interest and the principal payment are sent back to the Bank of North Dakota, which then turns around and reports that interest as profit to the state, and then a decision is whether or not it's returned to the general fund of the state or kept as capital within the bank. In either case, it's returned to the people. And so you end up with this excellent closed-circuit approach to funding infrastructure projects using a public bank without borrowing money from wealthy people who are always looking for long-term, low-risk investments for their money. Contrast that with what's done here in California, where we have this San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. And, you know, over 20 years ago, because of the earthquake, it was decided it needed to be retrofitted. And, you know, fast forward over the couple of decades now, it's cost $6 billion in materials and services to retrofit the bridge. It's going to cost another $6 billion of interest and fees. And so we're basically doubling our cost. And all that is because we were not using a public bank. If we had a public bank of the state of California, we could have financed that ourselves. You know, the state treasurer could, if he were on the board for the public bank, could have redirected $6 billion of bank credit to fund the bridge. Any interest payments would have gone back to the state coffers, and there would have been very little interest and fees associated with that transaction. The problem is we are reliant upon Wall Street banks to fund large projects like that, and we end up having to pay a huge amount in debt servicing costs, which is reflected in every government budget at anywhere from 20 to 30% or so. And those debt servicing costs could be avoided completely if we financed projects, public projects, with our own public bank.
Okay, I just want to pause here and just say how remarkable this possibility is. And, you know, we're talking about the possibility of creating government-owned banks, either, you know, city-owned or state-owned banks, and using the funds that we, the taxpayers, are putting in for income tax or for sales tax or whatever revenue is generated by the government. We put that money in. Right now that money's going into the private banks, mostly the private banks of Wall Street, the big financial institutions. And what you're saying is it doesn't have to be that way, that the states could take that public revenue, take that public money, put it into a publicly owned bank, and use it for a variety of purposes that serve the people of that state. And I love your example in terms of building infrastructure. You know, we all keep hearing about the need. You know, our roads and our bridges are in disrepair because we haven't been investing enough over the past many decades in it. You know, we had that bridge in Minneapolis that collapsed, and, you know, that kind of stuff could happen anywhere, really, in the country. We need our water pipelines, some of them, you know, a century old, and needing to be either repaired or replaced. So we have tremendous amount of need for that to be done. And right now, that need is pressing, yet a lot of the states are in a situation where they are having less revenue and they're having to cut what they're already supposed to be paying for. And they're really feeling stressed and stretched about how are we going to pay for building the new water systems and roads and bridges that we need. And you're saying that this is already being done successfully by North Dakota, that the Bank of North Dakota actually financed this water pipeline and with the funds, you know, public funds for that public investment in the water system. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just 2 days ago, I was reading this list of the best airports in the world. I was specifically looking for U.S. airports, and the first U.S. airport that showed up on it was way down the list, around 30 or 40, and it was San Francisco. But what was what's interesting is many of these airports are in countries that have their own public banks. And I know that 3 years ago, China committed to build over 70 airports within 5 years. And you know, we can't even have those conversations in this country because we've outsourced money creation to the private banks. And it's not allowed. I mean, the only way that our government can raise money, essentially, in many people's minds, is by taxing people. Well, other countries realize that there are other ways to get money. And one way is to have your own bank and use that to use bank credit to fund projects. Keep in mind that when you use bank credit, it's not inflationary. Because let's go back to the Bay Bridge example. You know, if we needed $6 billion to retrofit that bridge, and we didn't want to tax people for that money, we could have created the $6 billion loan, which would have been used to buy steel, to, you know, place the contracts, employ people, et cetera. And let's say that $6 billion was spent into the economy. Well, there's a toll for usage of the bridge. And, you know, it's a $6 toll, and in a very quick amount of time, that $6 billion can be paid back, and it disappears. It no longer is in circulation in the economy. So it's not inflationary, but at the end of the day, you end up with this bridge, which you did not have before.
Right.
And that's the beauty of bank credit. You can use it to build things, and you're actually improving the wealth and the livelihoods of the people in your community and the economy, but it's not inflationary because the money that is put into the economy is only temporary and it's pulled back out with loan repayments. And so other countries realize that. They use banks to further the common good of their people. And yet in this country, we have this ongoing debate about taxes, and we never talk about debt servicing costs. And yet we're stymied because our economy is stymied because we've got all these people who are able to work. We've got tremendous wealth in terms of infrastructure, other things within our economy, but we can't put it all together because we don't have the financing to make it happen. And that's because the financing is controlled by a very small group of people on Wall Street who could relinquish the reins on this, but that's the nature of public banking. We just want to take public funds out of those banks, put it into public banks, and return control back to the local level at the state and county level.
Fantastic. And I want to pick up on your San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge example again, because one of the things you said really caught my attention, and it's to this point about getting the money to be able to pay for these investments in infrastructure development, roads, bridges, water systems, things that help us all live our lives, help our businesses, you know, get built and expand and create jobs. We need to have an upgrade there nationwide. And it was very interesting to me. You mentioned that the cost for that San Francisco Bay Bridge was $6 billion in materials and services, and then another $6 billion in interest and fees. So we're paying as much as the taxpayer here. We're paying as much in the interest and fees as we are for actually building the bridge. And this was something that was shocking to me when I bought my first home. And I forget the exact numbers, but it was something like I was borrowing $200,000 that would be paid off to buy the home, and the interest on the 30-year loan was going to cost me $400,000. So that the person who actually was selling me the house got the $200,000, and the bank that was financing my home mortgage was making twice as much money as the person who actually owned the property. And it was shocking to me that this, you know, whoever had the money was making money off the money. They didn't have the property at all. They were just kind of loaning the funds, and there it was, and they end up with twice as much as the person who actually had the property. So we can see that in so many places, the cost of debt servicing, the cost of borrowing the money can really be a huge burden. But you're saying let's use our public money, put it into a public bank, and we can use that to fund public improvements like roads and bridges.
Right. We can use the bank credit to fund that. And keep in mind, bank credit is pretty special. It's you know, what we're doing is basically giving a license to a bank to create this asset. You know, if a bank did not have this special dispensation or different special license from the state or federal authorities, what would happen is they would take in $100 deposit, and if they truly were then lending out the deposit, they would not have that $100 left for the depositor. That's not how it works. What happens is they take in the $100, they're allowed to create bank credit that's worth another $100, and that is what is lent out. It's an asset of the bank. And so we need to keep this distinction. Many people say that banks lend out their deposits. That is not true. They lend out bank credit, and it's simply double entry accounting, but it's a special license they've been given. You and I can't do that. We can't take in $100 from someone. Eleanor, I can't give you $100, and then you lend it out to someone, and then still have $100 left for me when I come to get it. No, it doesn't work that way. The banks are pretty special, but remember, this is simply a privilege we've given them. This is not a right that we've given them. And so what we can do is simply use that privilege for ourselves and use it in a way to further the interests of the people. Getting back to the interest question, Eleanor, you know, it's a lot worse, frankly, than the example you gave about home mortgage payments. There are products in the marketplace right now. These are toxic products. They're called capital appreciation bonds. These are being sold by investment banks to school districts, at least out here in California. There's an article in the San Francisco Chronicle just 2 months ago, and here are the numbers. Over the last 7 years, $9 billion has been borrowed by school districts to build schools, to improve schools, et cetera. $9 billion. That money is going to need to be paid back in about 25 years with a $26 billion price tag for interest on top of it.
Oh,
no. The total amount is going to be $35 billion that needs to be paid back to Wall Street banks because of this toxic product that they have in the marketplace. Now, it is perfectly legal in California for them to do that. As a matter of fact, it's necessary because we are starving school districts and other very important functions in our economy from getting more money to do important things like building schools. You know, we can't raise taxes. We're bonded out. There are lots of things that we cannot do anymore. And so we end up forcing them into buying these toxic products, which is basically just kicking the can down to the next generation of taxpayers.
Right.
And that is not taking care of the next generation. It's defaulting on our responsibility. And if we had a state-owned bank, we could do it in a heartbeat. We could fund that $9 billion in a heartbeat.
Right. All right. Hold that thought, Mark. We're going to pause now for a break and be back talking with Mark Armstrong about public banking. This is Eleanor LaCane speaking with my guest, Mark Armstrong, on All Together Now. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane speaking with my guest, Mark Armstrong, Executive Director of the Public Banking Institute. We're talking about the idea of taking public money and putting it into a publicly owned bank and using it to finance home mortgages, local businesses, and disaster recovery and infrastructure, like helping build our roads and bridges, getting them up to speed in a way that we could do it and save huge amounts of money, hundreds of billions of dollars on money that the taxpayers are now spending on the interest for loans being given by the private banks. So, Mark, you were talking just before the break. That's another great example of there in California. Now, the state is paying for school buildings, but they're paying a huge amount on interest. And you're saying if we had a public bank in California, like they do have the Public Bank of North Dakota, that the citizens of California could save that interest money. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah. And in the case of the loan, the bonds that are being financed currently, they're called capital appreciation bonds, and they're designed basically so that payments don't need to be made for a couple of decades. And because of that and other reasons, the interest rate goes way up, and it's just shifting the payment responsibility to the next generation of taxpayers, which is really not fair to our sons and daughters.
Yeah, and we're all concerned. We keep hearing about, the government is broke and we can't finance the Social Security, we can't pay our bills, we got to cut $1 trillion in the federal budget, and the states are all cutting. And what I see is you're talking about an approach that is actually very simple but extremely powerful. It's about citizens taking control more of the tax revenue and using public money for public good. And why do we have to be putting our public money into private banks and them then loaning it back so that, we the people are borrowing it to build our roads and bridges? Why not just put it in a publicly owned bank?
That's the irony of all this. We're putting all this money into private banks, and then we're basically paying an arm and a leg for the privilege of borrowing back what is bank credit. Why don't we just put it into our own public bank, create the bank credit, and lend it back to ourselves? You end up paying the interest, whatever interest there is, to yourselves as opposed to paying it to out-of-state Wall Street bankers. It's just common sense.
Mm-hmm. So, Mark, you've been at this for a while, and I so admire you and appreciate you, your dedication to this whole concept, because, there's no single bullet that's going to turn the economy around, but of everything that I've seen, this idea about having a publicly owned bank is something that in one relatively simple step, the citizens and our government could reclaim those funds and save hundreds of billions of dollars that we're paying now in interest, borrowing our own money back from the Wall Street financial institution. Do you have a sense if all 50 states say, that's a great idea, we want to do a public bank, do you have a sense of how much money that would then shift from the Wall Street financial institutions and into more public interest?
Well, you can do the math with the state of North Dakota. When you run out the deposits per capita, it ends up for the entire country to being well over $1 trillion. So like $1.5 trillion. So let's just be conservative. Let's say it's $1 trillion of deposits that would be placed into public banks throughout the country. So we're talking about each of the 50 states, as well as a number of counties, as well as cities, and the numbers add up quite a bit. I mean, that's a lot of credit that can be used to fund what we've been talking about.
Yeah, this is huge. This is a game changer. I think about $1 trillion kind of spread out about all 50 states. That would go a long way to help the states that are now struggling to pay their bills.
Right. It could not be used as a budgetary line item, of course. I mean, this
right.
is used basically to build up the economies of these states. Now, one of the issues is, you know, many of us value buy local, and many of us certainly value buy American, you know, that whole concept. But there are trade agreements. The Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement is being negotiated, and from draft copies, what we've seen is that the buy American interest that or value that many of us have, that will be prohibited from government procurement contracts. And so we end up in a situation where our economies, our local economies at the county and state level, the government, school districts, whatnot, are not going to be able to give preferential treatment to companies that are producing locally. You know, you will not be able to say that the material or food or whatever is going to be in this government contract has to be produced locally. That would be against the TPP regulations that are being negotiated. And so in North Dakota, the 1% per year commercial loan I mentioned to you, that would be violating the TPP agreement. Mm-hmm. And so there's all sorts of clauses that are being discussed as part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which strike at the heart of public banking as well as at the heart of many of the values that all of us have for buying American or buying local and allowing our local governments to do that.
Yeah. You know, I just had this thought in talking to you when you said if the states would put the public revenue in public banks, that would generate over $1 trillion in deposits. That is fabulous right there. But then it actually is way more significant than that, because not only do we have the deposits available, we would also save money in what we're paying and all that big interest to the big banks.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
It's phenomenal what this could do.
Yeah, it really does. It is a game changer because it basically puts power back in the hands of people. We default to either Wall Street or to Congress when we talk about our economy. We think that, you know, the levers of power are there. When in actuality, because of the huge amount of deposits that we have and the ability to create credit through a banking institution, you know, we at the local level, whether it's Sonoma County where I live or here in the state of California or Oregon, we could actually create all this credit and use it to direct our own economies, very much like they do in North Dakota. It does not require a decision, permission from Wall Street bankers. We don't need permission from Congress. It is something that we can do at the local level.
Fantastic. I love that. I want to go back to something you said there that's very significant that a lot of people don't know, and I myself didn't know this until you helped me see it. But you talked about that the bank has a license to give credit. And when the bank, say, you know, I make a $100 deposit in the bank, it isn't that the bank takes that $100 and loans that out. In fact, there's this whole leveraging they can do, and that if I put $100 as a deposit in a bank, that bank can then loan out 10 times the value of that $100. So when I put in $100, the bank can then loan out $1,000, even though it doesn't have that money secured in its safe. Is that right?
Well, when you're using those type of numbers, we're talking about something different. I mean, that's called the fractional reserve system, and that's over the entire system. We can't be just talking about one bank. Mm-hmm. We're talking about if you put $100 in the bank, it lends out $100, or it's actually more like $90, and then that $90 becomes a deposit in another bank. And then that other bank can lend out $80 and so on. So you end up with this net effect of 10 times or so more than that original $100 that was in deposit.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to look at the whole system in aggregate. But yes, that's correct when you look at it from the perspective of including multiple banks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that gives the financial institutions, they can loan out way more than what actually, you know, we put out and give in hand.
Right, and what I want to draw attention to on that example is the fractional reserve system assumes that there's real money and there's fake money. You know, critics of the fractional reserve system, I should say. I mean, the real money is what was the deposit, and the fake money are the, is this loans that are put out there. But let me just be real clear. There's no real, the only real money in the system is what we produce and is circulating. I mean, 90% of the money supply comes from loans, and it's a U.S. dollar no matter what. And so, you know, and it's not, it's guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the government. It's not guaranteed by gold or silver or precious metals. And so, it's what we have. It's kind of the rules of the system. The bottom line question is how much is needed in circulation in order to make sure we have full employment, in order to make sure we have bridges that are built, in order to make sure we have water pipelines and whatnot. You know, that's the real question, and you just create whatever you need to do that and then pay it back once those projects are built. And so you end up with in a situation where you can improve the wealth and the livelihoods of the people in the economy by using bank credit, which, yes, is based on the fractional reserve system. But the determining factor is really the health of the economy, how many people are employed, as opposed to whether or not it's based upon, you know, some the real money, which is in the bank vault, and the fake money, which is circulating or in the form of loans.
Yeah.
It's very similar to frequent flyer miles. I like to use the example. When frequent flyer miles are returned to the issuer, let's say United Airlines, you're returning 20,000 to get a seat. Those 20,000 miles don't go into a vault and, you know, with a couple of armed guards in front of it. They disappear. It's simply an accounting transaction. That's the nature of money. It's simply accounting. And then there are rules of the system we have to adhere to, such as fractional reserve lending. The question is whether or not we're going to use it to further the interests of the people or to further the interests of a few small shareholders in Bank of America or whatever.
Right. So I know there are people who raise criticism of the concept of a state-owned bank, public bank, and the most common criticism I've heard is that they're concerned that if the government is running a state-owned bank, say, that the bank would be too political, that the politicians would use that state-owned bank to favor their friends and donors. What do you say to that concern?
Well, the best way for me to comment on that is just to point to what is done in Bank of North Dakota. The politicians are not involved in the running of the bank. It's an independent corporate entity that's run by professional bankers. The board is comprised of three elected officials, and so you can say that the governance or the policy is set by those people, but they are not the operating management. They are not in a position to make a decision as to who gets what loan. So there are control points in place with the Bank of North Dakota to prohibit the situation or the scenario that you describe. Furthermore, the Bank of North Dakota is actually in a position where their main output, what they produce, are loan programs. You know, you cannot go into the bank and take out a loan. Those loan programs are for their 110 community bank partners, and it's those community banks that enroll themselves in these programs and actually extend it to their customers. And you would actually be just dealing with your own community banker, and they make a decision as to whether or not you get a particular loan as part of one of the Bank of North Dakota loan programs. So you end up with a situation where it's private bankers who are actually still making lending decisions. They're involved in the origination. And so you further prevented the situation where a state employee, you know, even if he or she is a professional banker in Bank of North Dakota, they're not involved in the transaction that's really pushed out to the community bankers. And what the Bank of North Dakota does is create and fund these loan programs and it's these loan programs which are targeted specifically at specific areas of the economy to grow those areas. And then it's a matter of the community, you know, having people, business folks who decide that they want to take out some debt capital in order to, you know, put in irrigation or whatever it may be, but they need $100,000 in lending. And the majority of that comes from the Bank of North Dakota. But from the perspective of the farmer or business person receiving that money, they're just doing business with their community bank. And so you end up with a very healthy community bank network. There are more community banks per capita in North Dakota than in any other state. And it's a very healthy, it's been well over 20 years that a community bank has failed in North Dakota. And you end up with this very healthy financial system and banking system, which is quite unlike what we have in the rest of this country, where we've got a lot of consolidation taking place. We've got capitalization issues for many of these banks. And so they're blazing a trail in terms of how to do it right, and we can just emulate that.
Right. And speaking of emulating that, I know you've been kind of like a Johnny Appleseed going around the country spreading this idea that we can actually have publicly owned banks all across the country. Can you tell us, is there any other state right now that's organizing to have a publicly owned bank like the Bank of North Dakota? And where does that stand for our listeners who are out there?
Sure. So there are a number of what's interesting about this is, you know, I've come from a jaded political perspective where, you know, I look at politicians, I used to look at politicians as waiting for a parade and then they get in front of it. But what's really interesting about this is that there are a number of elected officials in state and county roles who have public finance background who immediately understand the merits and the value of this. And they write their own bills well before there's any sort of grassroots support for a public bank. And so we've seen a lot of that happen, and it's really encouraging to see. I mean, it's great to see these politicians. They do end up being out on a limb because they don't have the political support that they need to ensure passage of these bills. But it really does show me that, you know, I was incorrect in my more cynical view of elected officials. And so it's good. It was a good learning experience for me. So there are a number of these elected officials around who are writing bills and getting them submitted. And the bills that have gone the furthest have been out here in California. We had a state banking bill study, which was actually passed by both houses, but Governor Brown pocket vetoed it. And then we had a full-on state bank bill, which was pulled at the very last minute. Massachusetts has done a study. And then some of the other states are in play right now, whether it's Maine or Vermont. There's some bills in Washington, and I think Montana as well. So, you know, they come and they go, but what we're trying to do to make sure that the politicians have support is we're forming a public banking coalition. It'll be officially formed and recognized at our conference coming up on June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th. And we've got a number of chapters from a number of different states and counties as well as cities. Philadelphia is quite a long in terms of this, and we'll have a strong coalition that's being formed, and the ability for people from other states to join. So just look at publicbankingcoalition.org. There'll be more information in June on that.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. I know you've got a good conference coming up. I was at the conference you did last year in Philadelphia, which was fabulous. A one-day conference on public banking, and the one this year, I see you're calling it Funding the New Economy at
right.
Public Banking 2013. So you say that's June 2nd, 3rd, and 4th, and where is that being held?
Yeah, we're doing it in partnership with the Green MBA program of Dominican University. It'll be held at their campus in San Rafael, California, which is a good 10 minutes, 15 minutes north of the Golden Gate Bridge. And we've got quite a few people registered for it already, nearly twice as many people as last year. And we're also having a special event on Sunday night, June 2nd. Matt Taibbi, the journalist from the Rolling Stone magazine, is going to be speaking, and he'll be joined by Birgitta Jonsdottir, who is a newly reelected member of Iceland's parliament. And, you know, Matt will be, of course, talking about the Wall Street banks. And between Gar Alperovitz and Ellen Brown and Birgitta, there'll be alternative visions of solutions to the problem that we're facing with Wall Street banks. So Ellen will talk about public banking. Birgitta will be talking about organizing over the Internet. And Gar will be talking, his new book is called What Then Must We Do? And he'll be talking more about cooperatives and alternative ownership models. And so it'll be a very interesting discussion that night. And there's a separate ticket price for that. For any of the listeners in the Bay Area, just go to publicbanking.org, and you'll see all the information about the conference and that particular talk that night.
Okay, great. I was just going to ask you that. So for our listeners who want to know more, because this is absolutely fascinating and a real game changer in terms of, you know, power to the people and reclaiming our economic power, getting money back into the hands of the people and out of the hands of the Wall Street reckless financiers. So to get more information, people can go to publicbanking.org. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And you'll have information there about this Funding the New Economy conference?
Yes, all the information is there. We have another event on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement on Monday night, June 3rd. That's a free event. But just go to publicbanking.org, and the information is pretty straightforward.
Fantastic. So we have just 1 minute before we close, and I'd like to invite you, Mark, if there's anything that hasn't come up in our discussion, if there's anything you'd like our listeners to know about public banking.
You know, we've only been talking about public banks at the state and county level. There is an alternative to do it at the national level, and that is to take our post offices and to have them provide banking services. You know, in most of the other developed countries, their post offices indeed do that. As a matter of fact, our post office used to do that until 1957. And so, you know, we could return to that, which is basically addressing the needs of many of the unbanked. We have over 9 million people in this country who are unbanked, another 10 million plus who are underbanked. And we can provide a set of core services to people through their post offices. And if you look at the landscape of the footprint of post offices, they're always where the people are. Whereas if you look at the landscape of the footprint of bank branches, they're where the money is. So it's time to get back to providing services to the people. And one way to do that is to provide some core banking services through the post offices. It's a great way for post offices to rebalance their balance sheet and to make some more income. And since many of these people are going to be are unbanked, it's not really taking away money from the existing banks.
Great. And then just really briefly, could you give us the title? I know there's a fabulous book on this public banking by Ellen Brown, who you work with at the Public Banking Institute. What's the title of that book?
The title is Web of Debt. Just go to webofdebt.com, and she's got lots of articles there, and there's a way to order that book there. She's writing a new book. It'll come out this summer, and it's going to be all about public banks throughout the world.
Fantastic, and I hope to have you back after that book is out, either you or Ellen Brown, and we'll talk some more about how this is actually being done, not just in the state of North Dakota, but in fact around the world. So
that's all
the time we have today. Mark, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you, Eleanor. Bye-bye.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives, and we focus a lot on my series on Breakthrough Solutions, which you can see at the website breakthroughsolutions.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host, Charlene Spretnik, will be here with her guest, Pat Mooney, talking about what's up with synthetic biology and geoengineering. I'll be back 2 weeks from today with my guest, Susan Collin-Marks, Senior Vice President of Search for Common Ground, an international organization dedicated to transforming the way the world deals with conflict, away from adversarial approaches towards cooperative solutions without violence. Thank you for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now.